Lancaster Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, and is always available for your listening pleasure at HallieCasterJane.com. Thank you so much for joining me. I am Hallie Kasser Jane. Today on the Hallie Kasser Jane Show, we're talking beer. That's right. We are taking an in-depth look at that substance that Benjamin Franklin said was proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy. With me on the Hallie Kasser Jane Show, author of Beerology, Mirella Amato, author of Vintage Beer, Patrick Dawson, and author of The Ultimate Beer Lover's Happy Hour, John Schlimm. But before we begin, a brief message from one of our sponsors. You are listening to The Hallie Kasser Jane Show, talk radio for lovers of beer. The Hallie Kasser Jane Show is always available online at HallieKasserJane.com. Today, the Hallie Kasser Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles in every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audibletrial.com/ The Hallie Kasser Jane Show. Mirella Amato was a woman with a mission who has dedicated herself to promoting local beer and beer appreciation since 2007. She is the first non-U.S. resident to earn the title Master Cicerone. She holds an advanced brewing certificate, is a national level PJCP judge, and has sat on juries for the Canadian Brewing Awards, the Great American Beer Festival, the European Beer Star, and the World Beer Cup. She is the recipient of the 2012 OCB Center of Excellence Industry Choice Award in Food and Beer Matching Development, and she can be frequently heard on CBC Radio. As well, her writing has appeared in a number of beer magazines. In her new book, Beerology, Everything You Need to Know to Enjoy Beer, Mirella Amato offers an informative, fun, and chock full of descriptive images and illustrations, comprehensive guide to the world of beer, and I want to welcome her to the Hallie Kasser Jane Show. Hi, Mirella, how are you today?
I am very well, and yourself?
I'm hanging in there. I actually am, and I'm so happy to be doing this because this is one of my favorite subjects, beer. So let's get started, and tell me this. Why does beer get such little respect? Do I dare mention the W word, wine, in my first question?
Well, I think certainly here in North America, beer occupies a very different place than wine, and fewer people appreciate beer in the same way or are even aware of its many styles and flavors. And a great part of that is the fact that for many, many years, we had a limited beer selection. So in the years after Prohibition, when the breweries were struggling, there was a consolidation of the market, and the selection we had diminished dramatically. And certainly here in Canada, for at least 30 years, if you were ordering a beer, it was going to necessarily be a golden color, a highly carbonated beer with a very delicate flavor, as little bitterness as possible. And you know, that was the beer selection that was out there. It's only since the 70s and 80s that we've started getting an increase in imports. And of course, the craft beer movement is out there right now, bringing us all these new styles and flavors. And it's only now that we have the opportunity to explore beer in a more in-depth way. Imagine how fun it would have been to pair, let's say, beer with a four-course meal if all of the beers out there were golden and 5%. That's like trying to pair a four-course meal with, you know, a selection of four different Chardonnays. It's not particularly stimulating. So, you know, now that we do have these many styles and flavors available to us, I think more and more people are taking notice and are eager to dive in and explore them. And, you know, it won't be long before we appreciate beer in the same way as we appreciate wine. I hope. I certainly do already.
I do too. And I'm getting a kick out of what's happening to the industry, which is why I so much wanted to do this show, because I think some people don't really know. But before we go further, I do want to ask you this. Give me a short history of beer. Ale is one of the oldest beverages humans have produced, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Beer has been around for an incredibly long time. The current theory is that beer predated bread and that we actually first settled evolved as a species in order to be able to grow barley to make beer. So it's been around for thousands and thousands of years. And interestingly, the way that beer is produced, the basic brewing steps and basic brewing ingredients haven't changed since those early days. The only thing that has changed is our understanding. So for example, yeast, which I'm sure you're aware, ferments sugar into alcohol in both wine and beer. Before we were able to put it under a microscope, people didn't really know what it was for a while. They thought it was God. Yeast used to be known as God is good. And there was another period in history where they thought that brewers were witches and it was magic that fermented the beer. Of course, now we've isolated it under a microscope and we're cultivating it in labs and we're brewing in stainless steel instead of wood and clay pots. But beer has remained pretty much unchanged in its basic formulation since that time. And then throughout the years in various areas, different techniques, different styles have become popular based on the ingredients that were available in those areas and the, you know, maybe laws that were passed, traditions, the foods that are consumed. There are areas on the grain belt, for example, in Europe where grapes don't grow particularly well and beer is favored at the table over wine, like in Belgium. So it's been huge evolution. But
it's a fascinating substance. Yeah.
Beer
absolutely
pretty much remains the same.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And that yeast thing, is so, it is magic. And I can see why it would have, they would have attributed some weird connotations to it. How did you get?
Beer was, at the time, was made sort of like a sourdough bread starter. So what people would do is they would stir a fermenting beer with their stick, and then they would take that stick and put it into an unfermenting beer. And all they knew was that the unfermenting beer would then start fermenting. So they thought it was a magic wand.
Yeah, it is a magic wand, what it does. No question. How did you get so involved in this? I mean, really, what an interesting pursuit, particularly when it wasn't all that favored. And I think you kind of got in on the beginning of it. Talk to me.
Oh, well, my passion for beer long predates my career in beer. I was really lucky in that when I first discovered beer, my drinking buddy at the time was, his parents were British, and he was very much into drinking import beer and finding craft beers that were brewed in a British style. And so I had this exposure to all these different flavors, and that was while I was home. And then I would go to university and saw everyone drinking the same beer all the time, people just sticking to one beer, drinking it by the pitcher. And I didn't understand why they weren't exploring the amazing selection that was out there and the flavors that were out there. So on a personal level, I've always been that friend who dragged everyone out, you know, to the fancy pubs where they have the fancy beers and, you know, driving out to breweries, asking brewers questions, which is one of my favorite things about craft beer is how tangible it is. You can drive right to where it's made and, you know, talk to the people who made it and ask them what's going on in the beer. So it's always been a passion on a personal level. I think at that time it didn't even occur to me that I could turn beer into a career. But let me tell you, when I did, a number of my friends said, you know, oh, thank goodness, you're going to bug someone else about beer.
Talk to me about this. What exactly is beer? You just mentioned one of the ingredients, obvious. But what else? I mean, do people understand exactly what it is, what its essential ingredients are? Tell us, without getting too technical, what
beer is defined as a fermented alcoholic beverage that is grain-based. So as long as it's grain-based, for example, sake could also be technically considered a beer. So it's grains in water. And then, of course, we need the yeast to ferment it. And the hops are added as a spicing ingredient. Early beers didn't have hops in them, but they have become a standard ingredient because they're a natural preservative. So, you know, we are all inclined to have beers that last well. Those are the four basic ingredients in beer. Of course, beer can have many, many more ingredients. I'm sure you've heard of wheat beer, oatmeal stouts, rye beer. Beers can have fruits in them. They can have spices. They can have, they can be barrel aged, they can be soured, so many different things. And then, however, if you take that fermented grain-based beverage and you distill it, then it's no longer beer. So that's why whiskey isn't considered beer, scotch isn't considered beer. It's just fermented and not further distilled.
Okay, and it's interesting. Beer as we know it, or knew it, I should say, is a change in. You brought up craft beers. Beer is no longer just our dad's beer. Pabst Blue Ribbon is one I remember vaguely way back when. So tell us some of the changes in the beer industry, craft beers, microbreweries that you kind of alluded to. What's the rage here? What's going on? How's it changing?
Well, it's interesting because people look at craft beer and they see it as this crazy new thing and all these new styles and weird flavors that are coming out. But craft beer is, at its core, at its origin, a revival. So in the time before Prohibition, here in North America, we certainly had a number of British-style ales being brewed, German-style lagers being brewed, very likely some Belgian-style, all kinds of different flavors available to us. And what craft brewers were doing at the beginning, so I'm talking about the 70s in the U.S. and the 80s in Canada, was just bringing these flavors back, or maybe brewing beers that had been inspired by trips to other areas that had different styles and different flavors available. And so in the early days, there were a lot of British styles being brewed, a lot of German styles. But now that the movement is picking up some steam, brewers are looking for new challenges and they're digging deeper, finding historical styles that have disappeared long ago, experimenting with barrel aging techniques, souring beer. I mean, you mentioned the W word earlier. but the way beer is going right now, it really has a much wider spectrum of flavors and styles available. I mean, there are beers that are brewed, well, there are non-alcoholic beers, but let's set those aside. But there are beers that are brewed at 3% alcohol. There are beers that are brewed up at 24% alcohol. In Scotland, they're making beers that are up to 40%. Beer can be sour, it can be bitter, it can be sweet. It can have any of a, I mean, I've had beers with lobster in them, beers with smoked meat in them, and these were tasty. I'm not mentioning the ones that weren't tasty. beer with gummy bears.
I know about that lobster thing in beer, yeah. But all right, I'll trust you on that. But I had some the other night at a place that were kind of interesting, that had orange tones to them, and even a sense of a pine. I mean, it's poetic at this point, is it not?
Absolutely. I mean, there are so many different flavors to discover, and it's really stimulating. Having said that, something that I'm personally very concerned with in this exploration is that we don't lose sight of beer's strengths. Because although, yes, it can be brought to the table and it's an excellent accompaniment for meals, and there are incredibly complex beers out there that are great to sip with friends or have quietly near the fireplace, at its root, beer is a social beverage. And, you know, it really shines at the pub, just hanging out with friends and sharing a pint or two. So I don't think it's necessary to geek out in order to really appreciate beer. Having said that, just taking a moment to think about the flavors of the beer in front of you, it's an enriching experience. It's happened to me more than once that I've been, you know, having a beer with a friend and we order the same beer and we have a few sips and I'll say something along the lines of, oh, there's a nice citrus note in this beer. And my friend will say, huh? And they'll have a sip and say, oh yeah, that is a nice citrus note. I hadn't noticed it, right? But just taking that moment to notice and think, do I like this or not? You know, from there, the next time you order a beer, you have that little nugget to share with the waiter. I like beers with a citrus note, or I'm not fond of beers with a citrus note. And then, you know, it can really enrich your day-to-day in so many ways.
You know, it strikes me as so interesting that for so many years, the W word had the whole, just held it all. Wine tastings, you know, this, that. And I never quite understood why not beer. But then I'm going to ask you this question. Is beer fattening? Is that what held it back? Is so many people worrying about that it was fattening? It's not, is it?
No, absolutely not. Beer is fat-free. It's cholesterol-free. It actually has a wider spectrum of vitamins and nutrients than certain and other alcoholic beverages that will remain unnamed. You know, the issue with beer, I think, is it's easy to, or rather it's hard to have just one. What was that chip commercial?
I bet you can't eat just one.
Yeah. So, of course, you know, people who regularly have, you know, four pints a night are going to gain a pound or two. But, you know, if you have four of anything, every night. You know, if you have four sandwiches every night, you're going to gain weight. And I'm sure if you had four glasses of wine every night, you would as well. But, you know, most people don't drink it in the same amounts. I mean, I drink beer for a living.
bad deal.
There are days where I sample more than 100 different beers. And, you know,
Are you running around the block every day, honey?
I say I exercise as much as the average person. You know, I hop on my bike and that's how I get around. But, you know, I don't have a beer belly, and I have many colleagues who also, you know, drink for a living pretty much. And let's not say drink for a living, because that sounds horrible.
Yeah, but it's and I like it.
Who drink regularly as a part of their as a necessary part of their job, and we're I would say pretty average size.
So,
definitely,
yeah.
No bellies going around. So that's a common misconception, and one that is interestingly is really pushed by the media. And this is a pet peeve of mine, actually. If you keep an eye out for it, I do blast it out on my networks when it happens. But when they find a health benefit to alcoholic beverages, they'll always have a nice photo of a glass of wine with a little slice of cheese next to it, or some grapes very cleverly placed. And, you know, the article will lead it with, you know, oh, that glass of wine you're having might actually have benefits. And then if you read all the way to the very end of the article, there'll be a little sentence that says, oh, and beer also has the same benefits. But you have to read all the way to the end to get
it. Right, yeah.
And firstly, when they find something damaging, you know, they'll lead with put down that beer, and they'll have a picture of some yahoo, you know, drinking beer and acting like a monkey. And then, you know, at the very, very end, again, you get to the bottom of the article and they'll say, oh, by the way, you know, wine also has alcohol in it, so it's equally, you know, harmful. And I don't know why the media continues to spin things in this way, but it is quite damaging. And there's been research after research after research done to show that, you know, beer does have the same health benefits and isn't any more fattening or harmful. I mean, drinking in excess is harmful, full stop, period. It doesn't matter what you're drinking, you know, alcoholic beverage wise. But beyond that, you know, in moderation, beer is actually quite healthy. And I don't know why the media keeps trying to vilify it.
I don't know if it's different up there. In America, it's always been associated with blue collar somehow in the advertising of it. It's never been given a high end, which is what I see changing now with this new, you know, microbreweries and stuff. So I have a feeling that goes with it. You know, here we drink it at baseball games and it's not very expensive, you know, and it's the guys, you know, with the big bellies. But times, as I said to begin this part of the discussion, are changing. I want to ask you another question about all of this, and that is this. You're going to laugh. We can't have a discussion. Let me put it this way. Can't have a discussion about beer without talking about pouring beer.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Talk to me about that, because I think everybody tries to get that right. Is there a secret here?
Well, first things first, always pour your beer out. Always pour it out. This is crusade number one for me right now. I'm still seeing people drinking straight out of the bottle or the can. I'm still seeing, people who work at bars serving the beer directly in the bottle or in the can, and that has to end. It just does.
Right.
There are two main reasons for this. The first one is the one that most beer specialists will quote, and that is that you can't really appreciate the flavors and aroma of a beer if you can't smell it. As you know, our sense of flavor, how we taste things, is greatly informed by our nose. You know, if we plug our nose, we can't taste half the number of things we would be able to normally. And if you're drinking out of a bottle or straight out of the can, your nose has no access to the aromas of that beer. So that's reason number one. But reason number two, which I find equally compelling, is that when you pour the beer out, you knock out some of the carbonation. And the brewer who made that beer is expecting you to pour it out, because that's the proper way to enjoy it. So that brewer has added extra carbonation to make up for when you pour that beer out and you knock some of that foam out to create the lovely head at the top of the beer. So if you don't knock that carbonation out, you're just drinking that carbonation and you get very bloated. I started pouring beer out as soon as I learned that was the way to enjoy it. So it's been years and years, and I had a really interesting experience. This was about 3 years ago now, when I was camping with friends, and, you know, we had the beers in the cans, and it felt a really awkward in the woods in the middle of nowhere to say, oh, does anyone have a glass? So I just decided to drink straight out of the can, and I only made it halfway through that can. The gas was so disturbing to me. There was so much more than I was used to. I just couldn't finish it. So those are two compelling
yeah.
reasons.
Yeah, and that's something I certainly had never thought about or heard before. Thank you for that information. That's that's helpful. I want to ask you this also, with that W word, with the wine. When we drink it, if we've been trained properly, or at least make the effort to look like we know what we're talking about, we put it in the glass, we swirl it around, we put it in our mouth, you know, we swirl it around, blah, 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 blah. Is there a technique that's proper for drinking beer?
Yes, and it's quite similar technique. I mean, you know, it's great to take a moment to appreciate the appearance. Always, always take a moment to nose your beer. Just have a little sniff. Make sure that your nose has access to that complexity. And then you can taste. The only thing I wouldn't advise is that that little trick when you put some beer or some wine in your mouth and some people do that and then they suck a little bit of air over top of it. Have you seen that done?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Beer is carbonated, so
ouch.
Proceed with caution. I've seen it done successfully, but if you're not thinking about it, it can get a little bit messy. Having said that, you know, it's not necessary to go through all of that to appreciate the beer in front of you. As I was mentioning before, I think it's as easy as just your first sip. Just take a moment to just press pause on what's going on around you and just smell your beer for a second, have a sip, and just take a moment to think about it. And that thought could be as simple as, do I like this beer as much as the one I had before, or less, or more, and how is it different? And just little cues like that, as you start, you know, picking up different nuances, it just becomes so much more handy when you need to then order a beer at a later time. But yes, there is a proper tasting technique, and I have that available on my website. I have it also, of course, in the book. So
Good to know. I want to also ask you this before we depart. But is there a way to gauge a good beer from a bad beer? Is there a formula to that, or is that a personal taste? What's the story with that?
I'm a huge fan of following personal taste. Judging whether beer is good or not is a huge gray zone. I mean, certainly there are beers that are, you know, that have been damaged, either because they weren't brewed properly or because they weren't served properly. The most common problem being dirty beer lines. I think we've all come across, you know, beer on draft that didn't taste quite right.
Yes.
That's usually because people aren't maintaining their lines. It's not dangerous or harmful, but it can really impact the flavor of that beer. So there's certainly beers that aren't in great shape. Beyond that, when we judge beer competitions, because I'm a beer judge, we judge beer competitions. The parallel I like to draw is sort of like a dog show. So there's an ideal of what each style should be, and we judge it against that style. So, you know, a stout, for example, has to be dark in color. It has to have those roasted notes, and we, you know, a pilsner on the other hand has to be golden and it has to be refreshing. So, in a judging capacity, we certainly zero in on what the ideal beer could be, and we can rate a beer above another. But beyond that, I mean, some brewers just like to freestyle and make their own beer and not really adhere to those parameters. And at the end of the day, if you enjoy the beer in front of you, then it's a good beer. And don't let anyone ever tell you, you know, that you shouldn't enjoy a beer if it is pleasing to you, because at the end of the day, you're the one drinking it.
Most of all, beer should be fun, right? There's a whole
absolutely.
World out there that is absolutely as much fun as you could possibly think to have. I know that you hold beer tastings. Other suggestions for people who want to go out and get into this whole new crafty beer kind of new movement to have a good time doing it? Any other places to go, things to look for, besides picking up your book?
Well, the book does have a number of different games and how to set up a beer tasting at home and tons of fun things you can do. But for anyone who's just discovering beer, I always highly recommend going to a beer festival, because when you go to a beer festival, you have a smaller glass, it's a sample size, and you can taste a whole bunch of different things and really start to zero in on, you know, what kind of flavors you enjoy, what kind of flavors perhaps you like a little bit less. The other great thing about beer festivals is often the person on the other side of the counter is from the brewery, they're knowledgeable, they can answer questions, and, you know, that's one of my favorite ways to explore beer is through festivals. Or, you know, you can also do a bit of a brewery tour if there are many different breweries in your area, and just most breweries have tasting rooms and knowledgeable staff, but the beer festival brings them all to you and you can enjoy and discover.
And fun. The author, Mirella Amato, you know, the only time I ever heard that name was in a movie called Designing Woman.
Hmm.
Go look that up. the name Mirella. That was the lead character, played by Lauren Bacall with Gregory Peck. The book, Beerology, Everything You Need to Know to Enjoy Beer Even More. For more information about Mirella Amato, visit beerology.ca. Thanks for being my guest on the Hallie Kasser Jane Show, Mirella.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers. Patrick Dawson is a respected voice on the subject of vintage beer. He's been collecting, aging, and consuming vintage beers for more than a decade. Accredited as a judge for the Beer Judge Certification Program, Dawson travels throughout the United States and Europe, collecting beers worthy of aging. He also reviews brew pubs for the North Denver Tribune. His personal cellar in Colorado is an evolving collection of hundreds of vintage treasures. Patrick Dawson comes to the Hallie Kasser Jane Show with his new book, Vintage Beer, A Taster's Guide to Brews That Improve Over Time, that has just been released. And I want to welcome him to the show. Nice to have you here, Patrick. How are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks so much for having me on.
I love this whole idea, this whole concept. This is all new to me. I love new things. Vintage beer. Who knew? Define vintage beer for us. What is it exactly?
So just, people are really familiar with the, how a wine improves with age, over the years. It's the same concept, but with beer. You always hear everyone always is kind of taught that beer should be drank as fresh as possible, and it, only loses freshness with age. And, that's true with the vast majority of beers, maybe 99% of beers being produced, but there's this tiny little niche, that other 1% that will show some improvement, much like a wine have some mellowing and develop some new fun flavors.
This is something I really honestly have never heard of. I told you off air, there's little that I don't know about, and this was a whole new thing for me, and I love these whole new concepts. But collecting vintage beer, is it something new, or is it something that's been around for a while?
Oh, it's been around for a very long time. The British have known about this for really centuries. But in any kind of large sense, it's really only cotton steam maybe the past 3 or 4 years as the American craft beer scene has just sort of exploded over these last few years. People are getting so into beer. They've sort of picked up this little niche as well.
So tell me something. How did you get into this? How did you, Mr. Dawson, get into collecting vintage beer? And is collecting the right term?
I don't personally like the word collecting, because to me, collecting is, you're not going to consume something you collect, let's say. You collect something to put on a shelf and look at. And, that's one of the issues with these beers is sometimes people get too attached to them. It's like a special occasion sort of beer, and they don't want to open them. And, when a beer is ready to be drank, it's ready to be drank. And, so that's the only reason I kind of like to stay away from the whole collecting term.
So what do you call it?
Oh, acquiring. I don't know. I guess
I like that. That's a good word.
Just thought about it.
So how did you get into it?
So I'm a home brewer. I've been a home brewer for a long time now. And I'm in a homebrew club. It's just some friends. We get together once a month and share what we've brewed and, sort of critique and taste each other's homebrews. And 1 month, a friend brought a Belgian beer that she had aged for 3 years. And I had heard of the concept a little bit, but had never really given it much credence. But I went ahead and tried the beer and was just blown away by the flavors that were in there. There were flavors that I'd never really come across in a beer. Sorts of sherry and port, dried fruits, raisins, figs, and whatnot, and just fell in love. And that next day, I started building up a beer cellar, and I had no idea what I was doing, and I did it totally wrong. I got all of the wrong beers. And those first few years, for the most part, were not very successful. A lot of the beers I tried were not very good. And it was sort of a motivation for me to go out and really understand the chemical processes and the different things going on in the beer to be able to determine the ones that are going to show that improvement over time. And it just became a really big passion of mine.
So are all I guess they aren't. I guess what you're saying is all beers aren't primed to be quote unquote cellared, another word that I like. But how does one delineate those that are from those that are not? Is that something you have to learn over the course of discovery that you're on with all of this?
Right. I mean, that was the issue. Like, that was the issue with me, was there was no real written guide. You know, this is especially, you know, that was almost 10 years ago. It was just very word of mouth. People just sort of, there was maybe something that they did with a couple of beers here or there, and no breweries were really doing this or anything at the time. So that was what motivated me. But getting back to your question, as far as, you know, what beers are going to improve with time, the big rule, the rule that will get you, let's say, 90% of the way there, is a beer needs to have one of the three S's. I would say it needs to be strong, sour, or smoked. So strong, at least 8% alcohol. Sour, you know, that some people may have heard of sour beers. It's sort of, I really hate that name, sour. People hear that and they think like vinegar, right? Like,
yeah, or very pickles.
Right, yeah, absolutely. It's not sour like that. It's much more tart, let's say. Like a lemonade, you know, a lemonade could be described as sour, but it's a good thing. You know, lemonade is an enjoyable drink. There's sour beers out there, like Belgian lambics and whatnot, that have that same character. And then smoke, you know, if you've heard of the smoked beers of Germany, it's a very tiny little group of beers, but they are out there. But what those things do, that high amount of alcohol, that acidity, or that smoke, is it almost acts as a preservative that slows the aging of the beer. And that's what's really crucial, because these flavors that I mentioned, you know, this is going to be one of the big reasons you want to age your beer, is to allow some of these unique vintage flavors, I call them, to develop. And they're very slow to emerge. They take a while. Typically, it kind of depends, but anywhere from 1 to 3 years until they show up. And you need to be able to really slow down the aging of the beer to allow that beer to still be vibrant and fresh when those flavors emerge. You know, obviously, you could age any beer you want, but if you just picked, you know, a 5% pale ale and let it age, it's going to go stale and kind of skunky before any of those vintage flavors emerge. So,
I like the word skunky. Sorry, you got me on that one. That's a pretty great word. So, all right, let me explain, understand this then. So what you're saying is, you know, by those three criteria, and when you go into wherever it is that you go to find these beers that you know you're going to be able to make as part of your cellar, you are looking for those qualities, and you know what those beers are going to be. Assuming that I'm correct on that, let me ask you this. So where do you find them?
Well, you know, it's going to vary state to state, you know, where you buy your beer. But basically, wherever you buy your beer to drink at home is where you're going to be looking for these. So in Colorado, it's going to be liquor stores, because our grocery stores don't really sell beer. They sell, like, kind of fake 3% alcohol beer. but you know, I know some states, you know, you go to your grocery store, but it's just wherever it is that you buy your beer to drink at home is where you look for these beers. And typically, you know, the majority of these beers are going to fall in that strong category. So we're talking barley wines, imperial stouts, you know, Belgian strong ales, things like that. And they are usually going to come in the large bottles. You know, they're about the size of a wine bottle. And in the beer world, we call them bomber bottles. So that's usually a good place to start. If you go into a liquor store, grocery store, wherever it is, look for that section, you know, that cooler section of the large beer bottles, and just start looking at different alcohol percentages and whatnot. Another great resource is going to be your beer guy, like at a liquor store. You know, I know the store I usually go to, the guys there, they really know their stuff, and they can steer you in the right direction as far as, you know, say, hey, you know, I'm looking for a barley wine, you know, a stronger beer, something over 8%, and they can definitely pick some of those out for you.
This is interesting to me. This is scientific. Is that your nature? Are you scientifically minded? Are you chemist, you know, or something? Well, it's so interesting to me how you're into the percentages and the... I get that. I understand that. But is that it? Is that what attracts you to all of this? What?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I think so. I'm an engineer. I've always been attracted to the numbers, I guess. It's funny, though. I never liked chemistry. I always just, it was like, I only took what I had to in school. But since then, I've read I don't know how many brewing chemistry papers, and I've definitely had to learn a lot more chemistry, but I basically learned just enough to understand the paper.
You know a lot. I read your book. You know a lot. Let me ask you also this. Why did you go for beer and not wine? Because wine has always been the thing that everybody is into, you know, for this kind of thing. Why did you choose beer?
Oh, probably a couple of reasons. First and foremost, I'm a pretty cheap guy, and wine is expensive, especially really good wine. Like wines that are going to be age worthy, you're going to be dropping a lot of money. Like a nice Bordeaux or something. If you buy a future, you might be looking at like $100 a bottle. Whereas you could buy a beer that's sort of the equivalent of that Bordeaux in quality in the beer world, and you know you're looking at maybe $12 or something like that. So you know, like, to be brutally honest, that's definitely part of it because I love wine, but I have a hard time dropping that kind of cash on it.
I hear you. And I have to say something, though, that which is really interesting to me, because your book is a gorgeously produced, put-together book, elegant.
Thank you so much.
And I would imagine that when you worked with your publishers, that was something that was on your mind, that it was a part of it. And I was just amused by that because it's almost as nice, if not nicer, than most of the wine books that cross my desk. This is a book that somebody's going to want. Trust me, it's that attractively put together. And, of course, the content is wonderful, too. So I just thought I'd put that word in for Vintage Beer Tasters Guide to Brews That Improve Over Time. Let's talk about the cellar.
All right.
How does one build the proper environment to age beer, properly? Is that a good word? Is an expensive investment? I know you're on the cheap, so it can't be too expensive. Talk to me, Patrick. What?
Well, I think everyone's situation is going to be sort of different. You kind of have to use the space that you have available to you. So the first thing you have to do is understand, well, what are the criteria? You know, what do I need to sort of achieve with this space? So first and foremost, it's going to be dark. You want to keep beer out of the light, just like anything else. Same thing with wine or any of these things, because the different plant matter in there can undergo basically photosynthesis from the light and create these very unpleasant off flavors. So that's the first thing. Keep it in the dark. Don't put it on a decorative wine rack, you know, in your living room or anything like that. The second thing is going to be temperature. The rate the beers age is going to be proportional to the temperature. So the higher the temperature, the faster the beer will age. And as I mentioned before, what you're really trying to do is buy time. You want these beers to age slowly so they can really achieve that sort of their optimal self. But at the same time, you don't want it too cold because then they just age at a crawl. You don't want to have to wait like 10 or 15 years to drink these beers. So it's sort of the happy medium that has been found empirically, and there's been some studies that support this, is about 55 degrees. So in a perfect world, like I'm very lucky, I have an insulated crawl space here at my house, and it stays very even temperature throughout the year. It might get down to about 50 in the winter and maybe up to 60, 63 or so at the hottest summer day. But it's really optimal. I'm lucky in that sense. A lot of people I know, you know, they might live in an apartment, they might live at different places where they're not going to have something like that, or like a root cellar is great, you know, anything like that. But if they don't have that, a great option is going to be one of those little wine refrigerators. You can buy them. I think they're usually like $100 at, you know, an electronics store or something like that. They're about dorm size. And what's great about them is they can be kept at 55 degrees or so. Some people want to age these in their food refrigerators. And while that won't hurt it, again, it's going to be too cold because typically your food refrigerator is going to be around 40 degrees or 38 or something like that, and it's just really going to develop at a crawl. If you don't have any of those things, you know, if you live in some tiny studio apartment or whatever, I know people have had somewhat good success with just putting them into your closet, your coat closet or whatever, as long as it's not an exterior wall. So that way it will stay the temperature of your house, which for most people is going to be around 70 degrees, warmer than you want. But the beer, it's not going to go bad. Like, that's one thing that's so important to understand is it's never going to make you sick. You know, it's not going to spoil. It just might not taste as good as it could. And the more robust a beer, the better it's been brewed, the the better it can stand up to those things. But some of those beers that are maybe kind of on the edge, or they might have turned out really well if aged at a cool temperature, if you age them in your coat closet, yeah, maybe they might come out a little bit stale.
Okay, so two things. One is that you talk about Dogfish Head, a brewery famous for making cellar-worthy beers by burying them.
Right.
So if you have land and you live in a cooler climate, you can actually bury them below. I mean, you know, why not, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, it's getting back to that criteria. Cool temperature, you know. What they recommend, if people haven't heard of this, Dogfish Head, a brewery out of Delaware, they make a 15% barley wine. I mean, it's just a bruiser of a barley wine. And they recommend aging it. You know, they say, hey, this thing is just going to get better with age. So they're very creative in their marketing and everything. So, yeah, they came up with the idea. They say, you know, dig a 3-foot-deep hole in your backyard, wrap the beer up in a plastic bag and bury it and wait as long as you can.
I love that. I would almost want to try that because that sounds so earthy. But so I love anything that's earthy. So listen to me. How long does it have to be aged? Number one, and how the heck do you know when it's ready? Is there a way? Is there a secret?
Right. I mean, those are two great questions. Those are sort of the million-dollar questions when it comes to those things. The answer to how long it's going to take is dependent on two things. One, the style of the beer. Some beers age faster than others. Beers like Imperial Stouts and their high amounts of roasted character age much quicker. In about 6 months or so, you'll already start to see changes. And for the most part, you're not going to ever want to age an Imperial Stout past 3 years. They're really just going to be going downhill after that. Whereas beers like some of these like lighter English barley wines, lighter in color, not alcohol, they can go for decades, but we'll really start to hit their stride at maybe like 5 years. So that was one of the things that really inspired me to write the book, because every beer, every style kind of has its own path that it follows. And I've been able to learn a lot of that both empirically and through some, you know, a lot of my research and just trying to get that information out to people. Because I know when I started my beer cellar, I would have loved to have that information at my disposal. Because, yeah, you buy that beer and you're so excited to drink it. It's really hard to wait. And, you just really don't know. And lots of times you rush it and you open it too early. And it's just not quite where it should be.
You can't see it, though, because most beer bottles are dark, of course. So it's a guess.
It's a guess. It absolutely is. So, yeah, it's a lot of just asking people, looking online. You know, there's tons of beer review sites where people can review beers. And you can look those beers up. And people oftentimes, if it's a beer that's known to improve with age, they'll say how old the bottle is. Oh, this is a 5-year-old bottle. This is a 3-year-old bottle, and they'll describe it, and you can kind of get an idea. That's a great way, if you don't know anyone that's opened one lately, to get an idea for it.
So, wow, that moment when you decide, I'm going for it, I'm opening it, and you never know what you're going to get, right? It's a surprise.
Yeah, it really is. And what's
wow.
A lot of fun, what's a really good thing to do if you can swing it, is to have a fresh bottle there with an aged bottle. So if it's a beer that a brewery produces every year or continually produces, it's a lot of fun to do those side by side and really see the development of the beer. And that's when you really start kind of learning. You know, I have a bunch of friends that do the same thing, and we'll get together and do vertical tastings, they call it, where it's basically you have a beer from every single year. And, you know, we might do like a 10-year vertical. So you have 10 beers, and there's one that's 10 years old, and there's one that's 9 years old and 8 years old and so on. And you just taste them one by one. And it's just fascinating to watch the journey of that beer. And you find that a lot of beers are kind of have peaks and valleys. You know, they might really hit their stride at 2 years and then kind of fall off and then come back at 8 years and things like that. It's just a ton of fun for a beer drinker.
And you never know whether you've hit optimum. Are you drinking beer right now?
No, I'm drinking water.
Well, why aren't we drinking beer? That's what I want to know. I mean, my goodness. But there's kind of a weird thing in all of this, because you don't ever know whether you let that bottle get to its peak performance, do you?
Yeah, you never know for sure. I feel like after you've been doing it for a couple of years, you start to get a good sense. for the beers when you taste it and you understand how different aspects of a beer are going to change with time, you'll taste them and say, oh, okay, this is going to get better, or, oh, you know what, I think this one's already over the hill. I think, you know, this has done everything it's going to do. But, you know, that really just, it comes with practice, lots and lots of practice.
Wow, that's really, really cool. So also there's this to me. Is there a ritual to all of this? Like there is the wine, you pour it, and then you swirl it, and then you carry on, and then you spit it out. Do you have to...
Thankfully, no, there's not. And that's what I love about beer drinkers. You know, we don't take it too seriously. You know, it's ultimately, in the end, it's just beer. People like to say that. You know, it's just beer. And I think maybe that comes from the price. You know, it's like you can't get too bent out of shape about something that was $10 or whatever. But yeah, we're not about the pomp and circumstance. You know, we take it very seriously. But yeah, I don't. You know, some people perceive that there's that snobbery and different things in wine, and you don't get that too much in beer.
Okay, but it does. You do suggest decanting it, don't you?
Very old bottles, I would suggest decanting. And you know, this is like when you're getting into bottles like, let's say, at least 15 years old. So beers that you're not typically going to be coming across, they will oftentimes have sort of a musty aroma and flavor just the first maybe 5 or so minutes. You know, I know in wine, sometimes they recommend decanting like 24 hours and whatnot. But with beer, I find that those volatiles blow off much more quickly. But it's just something good to know, because sometimes people come across these old bottles and they, you know, it's always like a very exciting big deal, you know, like a 50-year-old bottle of beer, and they have all their friends over and try it. And, you know, they pour it and everybody only gets like a tiny little 1 ounce pour. And immediately they're like, oh, this is no good, this went bad, blah, blah. And it's, they don't spend the time, because they only have that little amount to let it sort of breathe and develop. And a beer can undergo just dramatic changes when it's that old by just sitting in the open air for 5 minutes or so.
So tell me something. How much did one of these little babies cost when you get one of these old beers? You're paying a fortune? What's the deal?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's still not a lot of avenues for these beers. There's a couple of online sites where people sell them, and on those you'll pay a small fortune. You'll pay a lot of money. You know, it's not unusual for some of these bottles to go in the thousands, you know, $3,000-$4,000. But for the most part, people are into beer trading. So I have a good friend who just got a bottle of 1869 Bass barley wine.
Wow.
And he knew a guy in England that had this beer, and the guy in England was really into American beer. So they just set up a trade. You know, my American friend got a bunch of American beers and sent a box to him, and the guy sent the beer over to him, and it was sort of a win-win. And for the most part, that's how a lot of these bottles end up in people's hands. Again, it's the beer community. It's pretty casual. I don't think anyone's in it right now trying to make a lot of money off of these things. You know, there's wine auctions, but there's not really beer auctions yet.
It's coming, darling. You can be sure of that. I can just see it coming down, and not too long in the distant future. It's the oldest bottle of beer that you ever tasted?
It was that bottle I just mentioned, the 1869 Bass barley wine. I got to have that last weekend, and it was a real treat. It was amazing. I mean, when you drink something that old, there's of course a lot of, you know, sort of other sort of emotions, I guess, that get tied into it. There's just something so much fun, like that beer, you know, we're drinking it and thinking of all the things that were going on in history at the time. I mean, Lincoln had only been in the ground for 4 years when that beer was brewed, you know, that sort of thing. It was just amazing. So there's that aspect that makes drinking these beers fun. But what was so great was this beer was purely, it was delicious. It was so much fun to drink. It had, it came out and had hints of molasses and blackberry jam and a little bit of pipe tobacco. And it drank almost like a really fine port. It had lots of cherries, some raspberry, along with some of these smoky sort of molasses flavors. It was just an absolute delight.
The author, Patrick Dawson, the book, The Wonderful Vintage Beer, A Taster's Guide to Brews That Improve Over Time. I'm telling you guys, this is really something different. To learn more about collecting vintage beer and about Patrick Dawson, who is adorable, by the way, I can see him right now, visit his website, patrickpdawson.com. Thanks, Patrick. What fun. Something new. Good luck with the book. Fascinating.
Thanks so much for having me on. It was a real pleasure speaking with you.
You too. Bye-bye now. John Schlimm is the international award-winning author of several books, including The Ultimate Beer Lover's Cookbooks and The Beer Lover's Cookbook. He will soon add a new title to his long list of successful titles with the release of The Ultimate Beer Lover's Happy Hour, which features over 325 recipes for your favorite bar snacks and beer cocktails. John Schlimm is a member of one of the oldest and most historic brewing families in the United States, Stroud Brewery. He has appeared on national media outlets, including The Ellen DeGeneres Show, NPR's The Splendid Table, Martha Stewart's Everyday Food, and Fox and Friends. He holds a master's degree from Harvard University, and I want to welcome an old friend of mine, by the way, John Schlimm, back to the Hallie Kester-Jane Show. Hi, John.
Hey, it is so great to be chatting with you about one of our favorite topics.
Absolutely, darling. I can't think of anything better. I absolutely cannot. So, John, I have to ask you this. This is so funny. I don't know why I was thinking this, but you know my crazy mind. Is Harvard a good place to get a PhD in beerology?
Well, I'll tell you what. The one thing I learned when I was working on my master's there is that it's a huge party school. So, you know, in addition to earning a master's, I think I may have earned a degree in partying.
And why not? It's a good thing. It's a healthy thing for your future. So, and it's, you know what? It feeds to what you're doing now, which is writing these really terrific books. And I love all of them. You know that. So I was so excited you're out with a new one. So here we go. Mr. Award winner for Best Beer Book in the U.S. and the Best Beer Book in the World by Gourmand International. Oh, my. The Ultimate Beer Lover's Guide to Happy Hour, which was previewing here on the Hallie Kester-Jane Show, because the book isn't really out until August, although you can get it in preview, I think, on Amazon. Yes?
Yes.
Right. Okay. So, but to this project, you bring the legacy of that family of yours, and it's a century and a half relationship to a great-great-grandfather who brewed what you call liquid gold, with little more than wholesome earthy ingredients and fresh mountain spring water. Talk to me about Stroud beer. It really is iconic. It's part of American legend, if you will. Talk to me.
One of the really great things about having worked on these beer cookbooks, and I've done a few now, is that I have gotten to really connect to that heritage and to that great-great-grandfather. You know, my great-great-grandfather, Peter Straub, he came over from Germany at age 19 with just a few pieces of gold sewn into his jacket and a recipe for beer. And, you know, he came looking for his piece of the American pie. And it's a story that's repeated in so many of our families. And he has really become very much a role model to me, because we think, you know, what we were doing when we were 19, and it wasn't traveling the high seas, you know, in search of our dreams. But I think there is something so inspiring about his story. And he has certainly become very much a kindred spirit to me. And for us to be able to maintain his brewery over 140 years later. You know, today we're now known as an American Legacy Brewery, which means we're one of the oldest family-owned and operated breweries in the country. There aren't too many of us around anymore, because so many companies like us have been sold to larger corporations that are not U.S. owned. And so we're proud of that heritage. I'm fifth generation. My cousin Bill Brock, who just took over as president of the company a few years ago, he's fifth generation. So it's pretty incredible that we've been able to survive that long. And, you know, we certainly approach it with humility and, you know, with an eye to the future, but also one step in the past, because we never forget where we have come from.
And I think there's something interesting in that, and that is, you know, so few things go back to the beginning, but this goes back in American history. So this is pretty cool. You know, we aren't that old over here versus, you know, our compatriots across the pond. Let's talk beer now. Let's just get into it. It's certainly come a long way over the time since your great-great-grandfather, I think it was, wasn't it, got himself all involved in this. And how we pair food with beer has similarly, I think, evolved. And that word pairing, hair so sophisticated. Oh my gosh. Is there an art to pairing beer with food? Not so much different than pairing wine with food. We don't tend to think of wine and beer in that same way, but there is a similarity, isn't there?
Absolutely. And for so long, we had the era of the wine snobs and the wine pairing. And, you know, I'm one of them. I love wine just as much as the next guy and, you know, just as much as I love beer. But we're really in the last decade and certainly in the last few years, we're seeing the rise of the beer snob. And I mean that with all terms of endearment because I love it. And all the craft beers and seasonal beers that are now popping up everywhere. There are just thousands and thousands of new ones every year. And so pairing beer with food has really become one of the hottest ways to entertain out there. And that's why I was so excited to write The Ultimate Beer Lover's Happy Hour, because that's what it's all about. It's all about taking your favorite easy-to-make bar snacks, who doesn't love a bar snack, and pairing it with your favorite seasonal and craft beers. And, you know, you asked, is there an art to it? I think if you were to ask some, they would say yes, and they would be right. But when from my standpoint, you know, my rule is there are no rules. You should drink what you enjoy. You should eat what you enjoy. But, you know, with Happy Hour, I'm giving a little bit of a blueprint and hopefully, you know, what I call a party in a book for those who'd maybe like a little bit of guidance or a few new ideas for throwing really fantastic parties.
I like that. I like that freedom of it all, because I think that's part and parcel of what alcohol is in our lives. It's the moment when we can, you know, go off the chart a little bit, have a little fun, enjoy, feel good. Let's prepare. How do we properly stock our pantries? What are some of the essential ingredients that any home chef, this is a quote from the book. This is how cleverly he wrote this book, guys. Home chef, pint guzzler, foodie, beer snob, and first timers alike need to get cooking and chowing down with food. That is John's words. I love it. So talk to me about that. How? What should we have?
Just like you said, I write my cookbook. So whether you're a first timer in the kitchen or you've spent your entire life in the kitchen, you can come to my cookbooks and hit the ground running and drinking and eating. But one of the things that I always put in, I certainly have it in Happy Hour, is the Ultimate Beer Lover's Pantry. And I basically give you a chapter of some of the main ingredients, aside from the beer, that you'll be using, such as, the berries that you'll be using in some of the dishes, the beans, the bread, the cheeses, the chocolates, egg replacers, because, you know, I lead a plant-based lifestyle. And so, one of the things I wanted to do with this book is make sure that all of my pals who are vegans and vegetarians could come to this book in the same way that my more carnivorous pals could as well. This is a book where everyone is welcome. And, you know, those are the parties I like to throw. Everyone's invited to my parties. But I also, for example, where a recipe may call for sour cream, and if you lead a plant-based lifestyle like I do, traditional sour cream doesn't work. So I link it back in the pantry section to a homemade version, a homemade plant-based version for sour cream. So I try to get everyone covered as much as possible because the point is, let's just get eating, let's have fun, and I think the cooking should be just as fun as the eating and the drinking.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So let's take a look at some of the basic nuances and flavor profiles of various beer styles. I think that's important too, obviously. So I'm going to name them. How about you give us a brief description? Because I think I'm serious. I think a lot of people don't know these nuances. You know, it's just kind of thrown at us, and we're supposed to have known it. Maybe we don't. Ales, for instance. What's an ale?
Well, an ale is a hoppier beer. So ales are your stronger tasting beers. For example, an amber ale or an alt beer or an American pale ale, even a barley wine. These are beers that have that stronger flavor. They're not for everybody. I myself am more of a lager guy, which we'll talk about in a second, but I love a really great, say, IPL, which is an India pale lager on a hot summer day. You know, usually in addition to being hoppier, it has sort of a citrus. It has citrus notes to it, and ice cold on a hot summer day, it's fantastic. You know, if you want to get really technical about it, Ales are fermented at temperatures around 65 degrees Fahrenheit to 70 degrees Fahrenheit, as opposed to lagers, which are fermented a little colder at 50 to 60 degrees Fahrenheit. You know, that's getting a little technical, but again, all that information is in the book because there are people who are really interested in those nuances. And, you know, at Strawberry, we have just an absolute genius of a brewmaster. And so I'm always calling him up to explain the more technical aspects. Because again, I'm the party guy, but every once in a while, I need to know, you know, what are some of the more technical aspects of beer. And certainly in happy hour for my readers, because again, like you said, there is an interest in what are these styles of beer? Because you go into craft bars these days, you literally are looking at a cooler or a line of taps, hundreds of beers. So I give I have a beer style guide in the book that goes through each of the different styles.
I'm gonna name a couple of them. I don't think we have time for all of them, but so let me just put them out there. Lagers and here's one: porters and stouts. What porters?
Yeah, porters and stouts are technically ale. You know, all the beers of the world fall into either an ale category or a lager category for the most part. So porters and stouts are actually ales, but they are really known for their hoppiness and also some caramel and dark chocolate notes. So if you're a coffee drinker and you sort of like that flavor profile, you're going to love some of the stouts and porters that are out there, as well as some of the other ales. You'll appreciate those notes in there. But I think porters and stouts are not for the faint of heart, because they can be
rich. They're very rich, right?
Rich. You're not going to drink them all night. I think that's why I maybe veer to the lager side, because a lot of the lagers you can drink all night.
and wheat beer. Let me go to wheat beer.
Wheat beers are so delicious. They are actually ales as well, and they are produced using a variety of different wheats. But they can also have some really fantastic citrus notes, fruity notes. For example, right now, my family's brewery is doing a Hefeweizen, and one of the first flavor notes when you take a sip of this Hefeweizen is banana. Now, there aren't bananas in it, but the combination of the flavor profiles, you can taste that banana flavor, and oh my goodness, that is one that I could drink all night. So, you know, wheat beers are a little less harsh tasting. They're maybe not as hoppy. They're a little more malty, and meaning they have more malt in them, and that makes them a little smoother and easier to just drink as long as you want to.
So you brought up craft beer, and these craft beers, I was at a bar with some friends the other night and was tasting a multitude to try them out for this show. It's fascinating what they're doing with these things. And you know what else? I love whoever is writing the ingredients and putting them together. It's a new kind of writing style. It's a dynamic. But chili beers and fruit beers and herb spice beers. I mean, this is really beer has come a long way, baby, since your great great grandfather, huh?
That is right. In fact, a few years ago, I was speaking at a beer festival out in Southern California, and they had a hemp beer.
Oh. Only in LA. San Francisco.
Yeah, well, this was closer to San Diego, but I'm sure up and down the coast this was enjoyed. And I have to say, it wasn't too bad. I kind of enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'll bet you did.
But I have a feeling that was not on my great-great-grandfather's radar either. But that's the beauty. Like you said, there's an entirely new vocabulary that's popping up. You look at the designs of the bottles, which are so cool. It's just really, really fantastic. The fruit beers, my goodness, I have in addition to the bar snacks, there are a couple hundred recipes for bar snacks and happy hour, but I also have about 150 drink recipes. And that's really where the fruit beers come into play. So, you take your favorite punch recipe, whatever it is, and you want to spike it with something other than vodka, which I love vodka, but or maybe even something in addition to the vodka, you find a really great fruit beer and you just dump that in right along with everything else, and you're going to be so happy.
And you brought it up, so let me go there with you. So you're having a beer fest. Let's beginning. Well, beer chuggers, different from beer shots, shooters, and chasers. And how about beer party punches and cocktails? This book is filled with so many dynamic recipes. You want Saturday and Sunday to come around so you can play with them. Beer floats and shakes. Talk to me. The possibilities are endless.
Well, one of my go-to punch recipes in this book is the beach party punch. And you'll understand why when I tell you what the ingredients are. So in addition to a beer, you also put rum, vodka, amaretto, and gin, along with a few fruit juices and some garnishes of fruit slices. But there are some big boozy power brokers in this punch.
An alliteration.
And I'll tell you what, when I went out on book tour, my first big cookbook was the Ultimate Beer Lovers Cookbook, which all the recipes were made using beer. And when I did the book tour for that book, I actually had the beach party punch served before I would come out on stage. Well, you can imagine by the time I came out, I could have just stood on my head for the hour and everyone would have loved it. You know, people loved it, especially I love seeing the little old ladies who were there, who I adored. They were constantly running back to the punch bowl, getting more.
In the old days with the pink punch that you would have, like with 7-Up or whatever it was, and some kind of, did it have liquor in it or did it not? Yes, we've come a long way, baby. You know, my God, that is for sure. Yeah, I want to touch on something here with you, though, before we go further, and that is this. Drinking beer and pairing beer with good food, but how about cooking with beer?
Absolutely. You know, that was the subject of my first big cookbook. You can cook just about anything short of cereal with beer. And of course, beer is sort of like liquid cereal, so you're covered there as well. You know, one of my favorite things, and it's super easy to do when I'm making a homemade soup or chili or some other stew, right about 15, 20 minutes before it's done, I pour in a bottle of usually Straub Amber, which is an amber lager, but you can pour in your favorite beer. And of course, you know, you look at what are the ingredients in the soup or the stew or whatever else it is that you're cooking, and you can pretty much just with common sense figure out what beer to pour into it. But it transforms a dish. You know, all your favorite marinades. Beer itself alone can be a marinade. You know, I love marinating. There's a whole section in Happy Hour with marinade recipes and sauce recipes. And, of course, I use them with tofu, tempeh, and seitan. But you could just use beer by itself because some of these beers are so flavorful and so complex and so full of delicious flavors all by themselves that they're already a marinade in a bottle.
Absolutely, no question about it. And they soften. It seems to if you're a meat eater, they soften, which I am. They soften the meat to boot. Listen, this is also interesting to me. You're gonna kill me. Here I go. Let's talk nuts. Not the crazy kind that you and I both know. The kind we eat. Sit at a beer bar. Attend a Yankee game. Beer, peanuts, all nuts. What's the story with this? Why beer? Is it a salt thing, beer and nuts?
Well, it should come as no surprise that since beer and nuts go way, way back.
Sorry.
Yeah. Company excluded, I suppose, not the two of us, though we go way back with beer.
Right.
But my happy hour starts out with several nuts recipes. Just because of that, you know, romance that has gone on. And I think you're onto something with the saltiness of the nuts, just like the saltiness of, say, a pretzel, because pretzels, you know, that's another thing that has gone way back with beer. But I just think that bar nuts, it's been an easy thing to have there on the bar, and I think nuts pair so well with really any kind of beer. I think that's the beauty of it. No matter what kind of beer you order, it goes with peanuts. Now, you know, for happy hour, I get a little bit fancier, even though the recipes are super easy, but I have things like cinnamon and brown sugar bar nuts, alehouse agave and chipotle mixed nuts, curried cocktail nuts, crusts and pretzels. So I kick it up a notch by adding a lot of flavor, a lot of spices. And again, a lot of this you can experiment with. You know, I think of my cookbooks really as blueprints that I hand over to the reader and they can just run wild with it. And I love hearing from people who really take the recipes and then go off in their own directions experimenting. And certainly, you know, when it comes to either cooking with the beer or pairing, with every recipe in the book, I give three suggested beer styles to pair the recipes with. But when you think of all the beers that are out there, the options are endless. You know, people are now throwing beer pairing parties. It's a perfect theme for a party because every time it can be something different.
I have another question for you that I really wanted to ask you, and I knew you would have the answer to this, and that is this. Is there like a certain time of year that certain beers work for people better than other time? You know, you say with wine, you know, you'll drink a Chablis, you know, in the summertime, you know, maybe with some on the rocks or something. Is that true with beer? Are there beers that suit themselves better to certain kind of weather?
Well, again, you know, I think that the rule is there are no rules, but yes, there are certain beers that have traditionally been served or produced during a particular season of the year. And in happy hour, I give a seasonal beer chart because there are some people, there's a certain magic, I think, to still enjoying a beer during the season it was meant for. So, for example, some spring beers that you might choose would include a cream ale or an India pale ale or a Maibock. Some summer beers would be the German Hefeweizen, that wheat beer that I talked about, a Kolsch or an American or English pale ale. A fall beer would naturally, you know, I think the most famous would be the Oktoberfest. And I'm so excited because my family's brewery is coming out with an Oktoberfest this fall, and I can't wait to have the first try of that. But there are a lot of delicious Oktoberfests out there. Another fall beer would be a brown ale or a Vienna lager. And for winter, I would go with something like the stouts that we talked about. There's one called a Russian Imperial Stout. And as you can imagine, that you drink that, you feel like royalty. You are sitting on a throne after about five steps just enjoying your coronation because it is so yummy and so rich and so delicious. Another would be a Doppelbock, which is a stronger, hoppier beer, a barley wine. So there is that allure and that magic. But again, the beauty for those of us who just love to drink beer year-round, these beer styles are now pretty much available all year-round, and you can easily find them if you want them.
So have at it. So listen, from a family that is the key word for beer, Straub, I always say Straub. Why do I always say Straub? Straub. Right. How are we as Americans standing up against our European and English compatriots, if you will? Is that the right word? This is the wrong word. But how are we doing now? We never got much respect. I think we're earning it now, maybe even surpassing. What are your thoughts?
I think that we certainly are coming into our own, and certainly this resurgence with the craft and the seasonal beers, there are a lot of really talented artisans who are creating these beers. And I go back to our brew master, Vince Aceta. I just watch him in awe as he's creating these delicious beers. And I know that he has, you know, brothers and sisters among brewmasters across the country who are doing the same thing at their breweries. We're seeing home brews become more popular than ever. I really think we're holding our own. And if you think about it, you know, the roots of these breweries go back to Europe. You know, my great-great-grandfather,
right,
18-year-old, he came from Germany. So I think that they and certainly his brotherhood and sisterhood of brewers that came over during that time, they brought the best of the best with them, the best knowledge with them. And we're now really getting to enjoy that with every sip.
The author, John Schlimm. The book, The Ultimate Beer Lover's Happy Hour, over 325 recipes for your favorite bar snacks and beer cocktails. And for more information, visit John's website at www.johnschlimm.com. Hey, John, let's not leave such a long time in between visits.
This has been so great. Next time we're going to dance on a tabletop.
I can't wait, darling. Always good to talk to you. Good luck with the book. It's going to be great.
Thank you so much.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye. Before I go, I want to remind everyone that podcasts of current and past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under The Hallie Castor-Jane Show. The Hallie Castor-Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com. Oh my gosh, a host of other venues. Just Google The Hallie Castor-Jane Show and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieCastor-Jane.com, which I hope you'll visit often for the latest information on our upcoming segments. And while you're at HallieCastorJane.com, don't forget to visit my blog to read my latest musings. I will be back next week, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of the Hallie Castor-Jane Show. Talk radio for fine minds, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/The Hallie Castor-Jane Show. Audible.com features over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's the Hallie at HallieCastorJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at HallieCastorJane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So till we meet again, that's the story. This is Hallie Castor-Jane. It's a wrap.